This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
And in so doing, I'm going to explain one Ramban and one Ibn Ezra. It's a short Ramban and it's a very short Ibn Ezra, but you'll get some kind of ideas to the work that has to go into the understanding of a Rishon on the Chumash, and you'll get a very good idea of why I always say that the art scrolls, which are a wonderful production, are perfectly in place for ladies and for intelligent children and for and for intelligent men who are not and for intelligent men who are not have no intention of being able to ever be able to learn one of the Rishonim inside, or for intelligent men who can learn Rishonim inside already. For all those kind of people, the art scrolls is okay. There's only one category of person for whom the art scrolls is banned in the space of Medrash, and those people, that is people who are trying to learn how to learn, which happens to include, I would hope, most people in the base of Medrash, because then the art scrolls firstly makes it too easy. One will never learn if one resorts to the art scrolls to see what the Mephoroshim say on the Pasuk. You'll never learn to be motivated to learn to do it yourself, and you'll see tonight what thought has to get into it. And secondly, of course, the art scrolls, as good as they are, is already an interpretation of the Rishonim. That's not just the Rishonim as they stand. That's already one man's interpretation of the Rishonim. And why should you deprive yourself of the opportunity of being exposed to the Rishon himself and to be exposed to it only secondhand? So anybody who's aiming towards being a bit of a Talmud Chochem mustn't go near the art scrolls. You give it to your wives and you tell them to keep it in their bookshelves, and that's it. And when your wives come along and they say art scrolls is not enough, well, they don't want to do little art scrolls, they want to do the Ramban inside, then you give it to your children. And then when your children say they don't want to look at art scrolls, they want to look at they want to do it themselves, then you give it to somebody else's children. And that's the way that one gets some kind of indication as to the progress of the Torah level within one home. But let me say quite clearly that for people who are unable or have no intentions of learning themselves, it's a wonderful, wonderful production. The beginning of the 8th Perek of Dvorim. Kol ha-mitzvah asher anochi metzavcho hayom tishmerun la'asos. All the mitzvah, which most Rishonim translate as meaning all the mitzvahs, which I am commanding you this day, you shall keep to do, or you shall study to do, depending on how one learns tishmerun, leman tichyun, in order that you shall live, uravisem, and multiply, uvotsem virishtem esoretz, and you will come and inherit the land asher nishba Hashem elok la'avisechem, which God has sworn to your fathers. That's the first pasuk. The Ibn Ezra translates it slightly differently. He says, all the mitzvah which I am commanding you this day to do, if you want to live, then do it this way. Let me read you the Ibn Ezra inside. Kol ha-mitzvah hatam, this means Im ratzitem lishmer ha-mitzvahs leman tichyu, if you want to keep the mitzvahs in order to live, zichru es aderben, etc., etc., the part that we're coming to now. Just bear that Ibn Ezra in mind, we'll come back to him. The next pasuk, vezochartu es kol haderech asher holichecho Hashem elokecho zeh aboim shono bamidba. And you shall remember all the way which Hashem Elokim has led you through the desert these 40 years. Let's stop there for a moment. So the Torah is instructing us, Shalom Aleichem. The Torah is instructing us to remember the 40 years of the Midbar. What do you think the Torah is referring to? It's a din, it's a chiyuv. We've got to remember everything which happened. There's a chatas kol haderech, that whole way, the 40 years in the Midbar, you've got to remember. What do we have to remember? Kriyas Yamsuf, the Red Sea splitting. Matan Torah, can you imagine? The giving of the Torah, the kolos, the lapidim, the lights, the voices. Ani Hashem Elokeichem, hearing God Himself giving the Torah. The Egel Hazav Nebuch, we must remember. What happened as a result of it? The Mechemes Amalek, the various wars that had to be fought, the moon coming down, the crossing of the... These are the things to remember. Let's see. Remember the 40 years which God led you in the desert, Leman Anoischo, so as to give you a rough time, Lenaso Ischo, to test you, Ladasis Asher Bilvolcho Hatishma Mitzvahs of Imloy, to know what is in your heart. Are you going to keep his mitzvahs or not? We'll come back to that as well. Vayancha Vayarivecho. Now what must you remember? What events of the 40 years must you remember? Vayancha, he was nasty to you like last week's shir. Vayarivecho, and he made you hungry like last week's shir. And he fed you with the mon which you'd never seen before, the lo yodun avosecha, and your father's never seen before. So the first thing you must remember is your hunger before the mon came, and then the feeding of the mon. So that you should, in order to advise you, to tell you that not on bread alone does man live, because man lives on everything that comes from God's mouth. Remember that you never had to buy a new suit of clothes for all those 40 years. And the Gemara talks about what's happened, how did they get washed, how did they get ironed, how did they grow as the kids got older, how did the clothes remain the right size. And the Gemara goes into all that, but they didn't have to buy new clothes for the full 40 years. And you didn't get blisters on your feet for these 40 years. That's what you must remember. No Matan Torah. Harsina, not mentioned in this parasha. Kriyas Yamsuf, not mentioned. Egel Hazor, not mentioned. The war of Amalek, not mentioned. The whole story with Bilam, not mentioned. What must you mention? Remember. Remember the food that you ate, and remember that you never had to buy any clothes and you didn't need any shoes. What's it all about? V'yodato im levavecha, and you shall know with all your heart, ki kasher yeyaser ish es benoi, that as a man punishes his son or educates his son, the word yayatzer is a difficult word to translate, and it comes from the word Musa. As a parent guides his son, as a parent trains his son, punishes his son, all these words are meanings of yayatzer. So Hashem Elokecho meyasreko, so the Lord your God trains you. V'shomarto et mitzvos Hashem Elokecho, and you shall keep the mitzvahs of the Ribbono Shel Olam bidrachav u'liyiroso, to go in his ways and to serve him and to fear him. Because the Lord your God is going to bring you to a lovely land, a land of rivers and springs, going through the valleys and down the mountains, the beautiful country is then described. That's the piece of Chumash. So our first question is the strange things that we're asked to remember. Remember everything that happened to you during the 40 years. What's everything? The mon that you ate, the clothes that you didn't have to buy, the shoes that you didn't need. That's everything. That's the first question. Second question, what does it say? V'yodato. And then when you remember all that, you'll know that when God was punishing you, he does it like a father punishes a son. Where's the punishment? He gives you mon for the 40 years. The women didn't have to bake, they didn't have to cook, nothing. You just took the mon and you tasted like whatever you wanted it to taste. What's the punishment about that? Clothing, you didn't have to buy new clothes. Your clothing never needed to be washed. Never mind that it never needed to be replaced. It was washed, it was ironed automatically as they walked. Shoes they didn't need, their feet never got sore. What does it say? And you will know that God punished you as a father punishes a son. Where's the pain and suffering? Where's the punishment? That's the second question. The third question is a very, very strange Ramban. He says on the pasuk, "Ki ke'asher yayaser ish et beno," says the Ramban, "Kein Hashem Elokim miyatzreka." In the same way, the Lord your God punishes you or hurts you, pains you. Mitchila, in the beginning, be'inui hamidbar v'nisoya in Hamon, with the suffering of the desert, and that we asked, where's the big suffering, and the trial of the mon. In order that by contrast, it implies, let me just translate it firstly, in order that the land and its fruit should be pleasant for you. That's what it says. So God punishes you mitchilo in the beginning, with the trials and tribulations of the desert and the trials of the mon, in order sheterav v'nafshecha toivas oretz uferosel, so that when you get to Eretz Yisrael, it should be a pleasure. I ask you, what kind of land is this that God's giving us that the only way you can appreciate it is by going through 40 years of concentration camp before then, and then when you come out, oh, Eretz Yisrael is wonderful. Is that a land to give to his people? And the way he talks about it right through the Torah, including right here, a land flowing with rivers and milk and honey and all sorts of beautiful things. Why does he need to give us 40 years of desert experience in order that we should appreciate this wonderful land? If it's so wonderful, we shouldn't need 40 years of experience in the desert. And if it's not so wonderful, who needs it? That's the question on the Ramban. Furthermore, on the Ramban, it means that Eretz Yisrael is inherently not attractive. That's what it means. That there's nothing inherently attractive about Eretz Yisrael. The only way that you'll appreciate it is by contrast from the desert. It's very strange. It might appear to be true to some people that go to Eretz Yisrael today, but that certainly wasn't the intention of the Ribbono Shel Olam. The intention was that Eretz Yisrael should be a model country, where everything works, where everybody's polite, where there's a fine standard of life and of living, where beautiful, no litter on the ground, nobody pushing and shoving. It was supposed to be a model country. In such a country, one doesn't have to go through to a desert first to appreciate when you get there. It should be something which is inherently attractive, but the Ramban says a very strange thing. And the Ramban was a Zionist, don't forget. The Ramban was an Ohev Eretz Yisrael, as all the Gedolim were, but he was one who was actually Moser Nefesh for Eretz Yisrael. And here he says a very funny thing, as if the only way one can appreciate it is to go through 40 years of the desert before. Very difficult. And then the implication is that that's how a father punishes a child. A father punishes a child so that he should suffer, so that when he has something nice, he should appreciate it. Just, it doesn't make sense. And the first thing in learning these Rishonim on the Chumash, or any Rishonim for that matter, or any Gemara for that matter, is to notice when something doesn't make sense. You'll remember the piece of Rambam that we learnt in his Hakdoma to Perek Chelek, in his introduction to the Perek Chelek of Sanhedrin, where he says, learn, and the important thing is that when you see something that doesn't sound seicheldik, not even talking about, you don't have to be a big Talmud Chacham, you just, something doesn't sound sensible, amot, stop, and then go on. And you lie awake at night, and you worry, and you learn, and you think, until you get it out. But that's the point to stop. And here we have such a case. The Ramban says something where we've got to stop. There's no way we can go much further in trying to understand the Ramban. But some people go through all the Ramban on the Sedra on a Shabbos, go through the Chumash, they go through the Rashi, to go through a Rashi, I don't know how one can do more than one Rashi per Shabbos, but okay, some people manage the whole Sedra, they're geniuses. But some people, in addition to managing all the Rashis on the Sedra on Shabbos, manage all the Ramban as well. I don't know, there really are great geniuses among us. The Ramban is difficult, but it can be tackled. Let's now understand. There's a bit of discussion among the Rishonim as to whether, when God says, or when Moshe says in the name of God, Vaya'ancha vayar ivecha, and he tortured you and made you hungry, Vaya'chilcho es haman, and he gave you the mon. Is he saying, I first made you very hungry and then I gave you the mon? Or is he saying, I tortured you with the mon? And most Rishonim discard the second way, and they say the mon is talked about so highly all over, it's not possible that here he's talking in a derogatory way about the mon. Yet there's a Gemara in Yuma, Daf Ayin Dalad Amud Beis, 74b, where the Gemara says the following: Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi, Chad Omar Ein Lo Doyme Mi Sheyesh Lo Pat Basala Lo Mi Sheein Lo Pat Basala. Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, one said, both agreed that the mon was not a pleasant experience. The question is, what was unpleasant about the mon? Says Rab, the one of them, there's no comparison between somebody whose basket has got bread in it and somebody whose basket hasn't got bread in it. Don't forget, every day they got sufficient mon for that day. Sufficient doesn't mean that they had enough to fill themselves for the day. Sufficient means they had what they needed for the day. And not one crumb left over. Now you know what it's like when you eat just before Yom Kippur or before Tisha B'Av. You can eat a meal as big as you want, and you can stuff yourself up to the very top, and the moment the fast comes in, you're feeling hungry already. Why are you feeling hungry? Because now you can't eat again for 24 hours. The knowledge that you can't get food, even if you want food, already makes you peckish for food. Can you imagine a situation where in your house there wasn't another thing, just enough food for one meal? Supper time, tonight you'll come home, there's enough food for Malava Malka, and in the rest of your house there's nothing. Not a piece of fruit, not a drop of milk, Not nothing, absolutely nothing. Water, that's all. No bread, no cake, no biscuits, no meat, no fish, nothing. No cheese, absolutely nothing. Just for a meal tonight. And there isn't a supermarket in town either. Go to the supermarkets, empty shelves. Nothing on them. Everything cleared out. Go to your corner grocer, cleared out. Nothing on the shelves. Imagine such a feeling. Okay. Now you sit down for Malava Malka tonight. How are you going to feel when Malava Malka is over? Okay. So you'll say, but every day the morn came, tomorrow there'll be more. It's a dicey thing to rely on that. Tomorrow there'll be more. Yeah, tomorrow there'll be more, but nobody quite understood how it came or where it came from. Everybody was very scared that they just had to do one little naughty thing and there would be nothing tomorrow at all. And if there was nothing tomorrow, they wouldn't be able to survive for another few days on what they had. They would die the next day. They had enough to live on each day, that's all. They had what they needed for that day, not what they wanted for that day. That's why they were perpetually hungry, and that's why they complained to Moshe Rabbeinu. We never understand that piece of Chumash. What are they complaining to Moshe Rabbeinu? Morn comes down every morning. How are they complaining? They were always hungry. There wasn't terribly much morn. It wasn't a very substantial sort of food in any case. And there was always that niggling doubt and worry. Will there be some for tomorrow? Do you know what it is to have kids in the house? And you give them your last teaspoonful of morn when they wake up crying in the middle of the night, and now there's no more. And your neighbors have got no more. And the shops have got no more. And Moshe Rabbeinu has got no more. There's nothing in the whole place. Not another teaspoonful of morn. And your kid wakes up crying at 6 o'clock in the morning. You go to the front door and you open it and your heart is in your mouth. You look at it, the morn is there. You collect it in again. You can feed your kid again another day. The same thing the next day. Always worrying, maybe the morn won't come. And don't think that it's just natural that it comes every morning, because on Shabbos it does tuck, it doesn't come. And can you imagine the worry about Sunday? Friday it's double, all fine. Lots for the whole of Shabbos. They've got to dish it out carefully to see that they don't finish it on Friday, but they've got enough for Friday and Shabbos. But Sunday is going to start again. Can you imagine their first Sunday, where they had morn on Sunday, they had morn Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Going very nicely. Shabbos double, Friday double, Shabbos nothing. What's Sunday going to be? Back to morn or no morn? Wasn't a nice feeling. Says the one of Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi, Eino doime mishiyesh lo pas besaloi. The misha ain lo pas besaloi. You can't compare a man who's got bread in the pantry to a man who hasn't got bread in the pantry. It's the same bread, it's the same quantity, it's the same quality, everything's the same except one's got some for tomorrow and one hasn't. Your ability to enjoy what you've got is diminished if you don't have some for tomorrow as well. So we begin to see that there's a part of enjoying the bread which has got nothing to do with the bread. It's really just got to do with your emotional relationship to the bread. If you've got for tomorrow, you can enjoy the bread more. If you haven't got for tomorrow, you don't even enjoy what you're eating now. Whoever enjoys a meal before a fast? Whoever enjoys it, there's no enjoyment in it. It's miserable. It's terrible. You're not eating for the fun of it. You're eating because you have to, because tomorrow you can't. That's not a pleasant feeling. And the other one says, Eino doime mishe roye v'eichel mishe eino roye v'eichel. You can't compare somebody who can see his food to somebody who can't see his food. Now it's true, you could see the mon, but don't forget, the mon itself was really sort of had one taste, but you could make a taste whatever you wanted. So if you wanted a roast for tonight, then you said, may the mon taste like a roast tonight. And you dished it up to the family. Did it really taste like a roast? Well, it did. But can you imagine eating a bit of powder that tastes like a roast? Tastes like a roast, but that's about all. Imagine a situation where the next day you want it to taste like a cake, and you're eating the same powder that yesterday tasted like a roast. What does it taste like? Okay, it tastes like a... If you stop and really just taste and close your eyes, if you've got a good imagination, it'll taste like a cake. But it didn't look like a cake, and it wasn't a cake. Says the other one of Rabbi Asi and Rabbi Ami, that was the yisurim, that was the pain that they had in eating the mon. That's very interesting, because what we have here is they had all the nourishment they needed. It could taste like whatever they wanted, but because of two factors, both of them emotional. The one is whether you've got for tomorrow or not, and the other is whether you can see it or not. So there's nothing inherently lacking in the food. The food is good, the food is healthy, the food is tasty, everything's fine. But your attitude to the food is wrong, and it can't be corrected, and that causes yisurin, that causes suffering. And the Gemara learns from here that a blind man can't enjoy his food. It's a part of the whole taste. Taste is a funny thing. We've often talked about this. There are really only four tastes. There's sweet, sour, bitter, salty. Those are the only four tastes there are. All the other things is imagination. It's a combination of smell and taste and seeing and thought and experience and all sorts of things. The rest is imagination. So imagine that we reduced everything to its basic four tastes and you could only taste four things. Sweet, salty, sour, bitter, that's all. Wouldn't be much fun eating. So the chesed of the Ribbono Shel, he allows us to use our imagination and our sense of smell and all sorts of other things, and it makes us believe that there are other tastes. It's all make-believe, it's fake, there aren't really other tastes. It feels like there are other tastes. When you take that feeling away, or when you take the sight of the thing away, or when you take the knowledge that there's more away, all extraneous things, nothing to do with the food itself, your ability to enjoy the food is impaired. You can't enjoy the food anymore. That was the Yisurin of the month. What about simla loy balsam me'alecho, that you didn't have to get any more clothes? It's very nice that your clothes were always neatly ironed and pressed and you didn't have to get new clothes. Sometimes one likes a pair of new clothes. 40 years, the same suit of clothes? Okay, even when one doesn't only go and buy clothes when they're totally worn out. There's a din that for you buy a new piece of clothing for your wife on Yom Tov, for Yom Tov. There's such a halacha. There's a simcha, particularly a lady enjoys wearing a new suit of clothes. Even if her clothing is not finished. Simla loy balsam yaleh. Rabbi Nishna says, so your clothes are good. You don't need any new clothes. Again, the Rabbi Nishna is right. They don't need any more clothes. But the fact that they can't get any new clothes hurts them, bothers them. The raglechem lo bateko. And your feet don't get blistered. Very nice. My feet don't get blistered. I'd like a pair of shoes also. So terrible to have a pair of shoes, but you don't need a pair of shoes. Your feet aren't getting blistered, your feet are protected. Like a pair of shoes. Why? They're all extraneous things, but when they're taken away, it hurts. And that's the experience of the 40 years in the Midbar that we've got to analyze a little bit. They had whatever they needed in the Midbar, but nothing more. What they needed, they had. Everybody thinks of the generation of the Midbar as that lucky generation that didn't have to work for a living. They didn't have to work for a living, but they only had what they needed. So we say, okay, if I only had what I needed, it wouldn't be so bad. Not so easy. Mon, the same old mon, day in, day out. Morning, noon, and night. Breakfast, lunch, supper. Yes, you can make it taste like different things, but it still is the same old mon at the end of it. And the first time it must have been an amazing experience. And for the first week it must have been really nice. First Shabbos came around, they must have been a little bit fed up to get the same stuff on Shabbos that they've been having the whole week. But okay, still, come on. By the time the second week came, the third week came, the fourth week, 50 weeks, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, kids were raised on mon. Mon, mon, nothing else. This little bit of mon that they used to collect every day. And they used to make believe that it tasted like different things. It sure, it really tasted like different things, but didn't help much. That was what they ate. New suit of clothes, no, everybody walking around in the same clothes, no shoes, or according to some, the same shoes. Wasn't easy. What have we got here? There are two ways of enjoying an article. Either you enjoy the article for what it is, or you enjoy the giving of the article. For example, if I go to Sotheby's and I buy a beautiful painting, I want to be sure that it's a beautiful painting, because my only enjoyment is in having the painting. But if my daughter scribbles some nonsense on a piece of paper and says, "Yeah, I've given you a painting," I wouldn't sell that for anything in the world. What pleasure can I have out of it? I wouldn't even hang it on my wall either. But sell it? I wouldn't sell it. You could offer me 10,000 rand, I wouldn't sell it. What's the difference? In the one, the painting is what's important. And that has a value. It has an inherent value. I'm prepared to pay for it. I want it. If it gets lost, I'll claim from insurance. The other is, the thing itself is unimportant. I can't claim from insurance anything. It's not worth anything. The act of doing it and giving it is what's important. Now imagine, I go to Picasso while he was still alive, and I say, "Mr. Picasso, I want to buy a painting from you." He says, "Sure." He says, "I'll give you a painting," and he scribbles on it. He has a painting. Fantastic. Wonderful. And then he says, "Here's another one." He scribbles exactly the same. He says, "Here's another one. Here's another one." And he starts dishing them out. I give them all back to him. Don't want one of them. Why? Because what's special is the painting itself, and once it's no longer unique and he's just making them off or he's printing them or whatever, it has no value to me. Imagine, though, the Queen of England calls me up and she says, I want you to come to Buckingham Palace to get a gold medal. Off I ran to get my gold medal, fantastic. Just get home and the phone's ringing, she says, sorry, I've just heard I've got to give you another gold medal. Back I go to get the next gold medal. 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 gold medals, it doesn't matter. Because I'm not interested in the gold medal. Getting the gold medal is what is important. So there are two types of getting an object. The one is where I want the object, and the one is where the act of giving is what's important. What's behind the object is what's important. Our relationship to the material world, we have to be very careful with. Because we have to understand where reality is first, before we start with all the romance and all the trimmings and trappings and everything else. Reality is, what do I need to eat? Do I need it to taste good? No. I need protein, I need certain fats, I need carbohydrates, I need vitamins, that's all I need. Put it all together, and it can be any kind of mush, or it can be a pill or a tablet or whatever, and take it, that's all I need. But that doesn't satisfy somehow. But one has to be able to distinguish between what we need and what we really are taking. And when we're talking about what we need, what's important is to realize that the material world is all a means to an end. There's no real value in any material object. There is value in a material object, but no real value. There's a big difference. Real value means inherent value in the thing for its own sake. That there isn't in an object. And that has to be learned. That has to be known. That in an object itself there is no real value. It's a means to an end. Let's take it a little bit further to understand it clearly. Assuming that I said, right, all I need is protein, vitamins, carbohydrates, fats. That's it. That's all I need. And assuming you made a mush, which we call mon. Call it whatever you want. And it doesn't taste particularly... Whatever it tastes, the taste is a bit monotonous, let's say. Certainly the appearance and the texture is a bit monotonous. How do I enjoy such a thing? Is it possible to enjoy it? The answer is yes, it is possible to enjoy it. If I see that in the same light, at worst, as I see my daughter's painting, what's so special about that? This is something which the Ribbono Shel Olam is giving to me. And to me as an individual. Because it's the right amount for my needs. It's the right amount for my family. He's measured it out specifically for me. That's very important. Imagine that the queen is driving down the road outside a big house in a golden carriage, and there are thousands of people standing along and looking, waiting, and as she passes me, she stops and she gets out and she says, I would like you to have something. What have I got here? A packet of matches. Please have this. And she gets back into her carriage and goes off. Would I ever sell that packet of matches? What's it worth? It's a box of matches. The queen stopped her carriage and gave it to me. That's what's important. And if she did the same the next day, I would keep that packet of matches too. So it is with a mon. If one sees the mon in its real sense, that means it's really a means to an end. What is the end? To stay alive. To serve the Ribbono Shel Olam, to fulfill my duty, to fulfill my purpose. And it's this which is enabling me to fulfill my purpose. It gets quite tasty. It's quite an important thing that I'm then eating. And where does it come from? The Ribbono Shel Olam's own hand. The Ribbono Shel Olam gave it to me himself. But you need training for that. In other words, when you take off the trimmings, to relate to the thing itself becomes difficult. Let's give another example. Let's say, for example, you want to... I employ you as an executive in my company, and I say, right, here's your office. What do you need? A chair? Here's a chair. I'll just give you a little stool. Four legs and a little stool. A table? Here's a table. I'll give you an old table. What else do you need? Pen? Here's a pen. What else? So, nothing else. A telephone? Here's a telephone. That's all. Nothing else. But why has everybody else got carpets in their offices and beautiful desks and comfortable chairs? Do you need it? I don't need it. Okay. Enjoy. Go ahead. What happens in a person's whole psychology? What goes wrong? When you're enjoying the thing for its true purpose, when you understand what you're really doing, you don't need the trappings. The trappings make it more comfortable. There's nothing wrong with the trappings. But you don't need the trappings. If you're working, why are you working? You're working to earn a living. Does it matter if you're earning a living on a leather chair or on a cloth chair or on a wooden chair? What's important is that at the end of the month you get your check. That's all that's important. What difference does it make what you're sitting on? Yes, more comfortable, less comfortable, but it's not a major issue. But if a person doesn't understand what he's really doing, and he's not working to earn a living, he's working for status. That's what he thinks he's working for. So that he can say where he is and how far he's got, and now he's a manager, and now he's a director, and now he's a managing director. That's his whole view of progress in life, is how far he gets in his business or in his profession. Then it becomes very important if you're sitting on a wooden chair or you're sitting on a leather chair. Because you can't go around telling people or telling yourself that you've made it. Somebody comes in and looks at you and says, "Man, why are you sitting in such a funny chair?" That would hurt such a man terribly. It would hit his very masculinity. But if the man is not interested, all he's interested is doing his job of work and getting paid, doing it well, getting paid at the end of the month, he couldn't care what he's sitting on. The trappings are important when you don't know what you're doing. When you know what you're doing, the trappings aren't important. They're nice, they're comfortable, but they're not important. You don't need them. And the more one needs the trappings, the more you know that you're off course. The initial period in the desert, or the full period of the 40 years, is Vayancho Vayarivecho Vayachilcho Es Amon. I tortured you and made you hungry by feeding you with Amon. I gave you just what you need. I kept you hungry all the time. I kept you unsatisfied. But you had what you needed. I never gave you a new suit of clothes, but you didn't need a new suit of clothes. Why do I need clothes? Just to cover myself up, to protect me and keep me warm, and to project a certain image. So if I've got clothes that keep me warm and protect me from heat and cold, and they're always presentable, they look good and they're clean and they're pressed and it always looks right, really, do I need a second suit of clothes? So you'll say, yes, that I can wash this one when I'm wearing the other one. Right, so the Ribbono Shel Olam is organized that it gets washed on the way. Washed, ironed, dry cleaned, the lot, all on the way. What do I need now? Depends. If I see my clothes as a status symbol, I need as many as I can get. But if I see my clothes really as only something which keeps me warm, sure, it's nice to have more clothes. It's nice to change for Shabbos. It's nice to have a special set of clothes for Yom Tov or for going out to dinner. It's very nice. But I don't need it. Provided I know what clothes really are. What are clothes? To keep me warm and to project a certain image. That's all. So I must choose one suit of clothes which projects the image I want to project and fulfills the purposes of keeping me protected from the elements. That's it. And the same with Ragla Choloi Bat Seiko. If I don't need shoes, I don't need shoes. What are shoes for? To protect the feet, to enable you to warm, to be able to walk, and so on. If I don't need it, if my feet are managing fine without it, according to some of the Rishonim, according to others, they had a pair of shoes with which they came out of Mitzrayim and with which they remained. Whatever the case is, I don't need new shoes. Very nice to have a pair of new shoes, but I don't need it. When ladies find themselves wearing shoes that they can hardly stand on, never mind walk on, then you realize that the world has gone mashuga. What's a pair of shoes for? A pair of shoes is to stand in, walk in, to feel comfortable in. If in addition to that you can make them look nice as well, that's very nice, that's fine, sure they should. But to have shoes that only look nice and you can't stand in them and you can't walk in them, that's mashuga. And that's what they had to get away from in the desert, to understand what shoes are, what clothes are, what food is. And so it was with everything. There's a need to understand the purpose of material things, because material things are not ends in themselves. And when you understand the purpose of a material thing, then you need the thing itself, and you want the most competent and the best thing you can get to do the job of work for which it's designed. If in addition to that you can have all the trappings, that's very nice. But it's not something you feel you need, it's not something you suffer without. And that in fact is what they're told. Remember all those 40 years. What do you have to remember about all those 40 years? Kol HaDerech, the whole way. What's important about that whole way? Just this one lesson. The tendency will be to remember Kriyas Yam Suf, the splitting of the Red Sea. The tendency will be to remember Har Sinai. These were the dramatic things, but they were the trappings. Remember the essence. The essence is the mon, the clothing, the shoes. That's what those 40 years were all about. And you miss the point if you don't realize that. That's what I want you to remember, says the Ribbono Shel Olam. Which altogether is interesting. We have a lesson here about when you want to remember something, see that you get to the essence. Don't remember the trappings, however dramatic they are, because you'll forget them. Drama is only momentary. The essence is something you can live with, but you've got to understand it first. You've got to learn it. So what we're told here is learn the lesson of the 40 years in the desert. What's the lesson? Until the point that your data in levavecho, that you know in your heart, it's ingrained, it's firm, it's intuitive. Ki kashe ye yasir ishes benoy Hashem elokecha miyasreka. That the Ribbono shel Olam is punishing you, you the same as a father punishes a son. What does it mean, the word same as a father punishes a son? There's only one lesson a father wants to teach a son. One lesson. What the world really is. Don't get confused with what the world appears. That's all a father wants to teach a son. Be able to tell a crook from an honest man. Be able to tell something of value from something of no value. Be able to tell how to spend your time and how not to spend your time. Just learn what the world really is. And the father will deprive his child of certain things so as to expose him to the world as it really is. When a father lets his kid fall off the bed, it's the thing which every father has to do in the early years of a child's life. That's what he's doing it for, to learn the reality that when you fall, you hurt yourself. That's all the father wants to hear, wants the child to hear. When the father lets a child burn himself at a candle or with a match, what does he want to do? He wants to hurt his child. No, he wants the child to learn the reality that as beautiful and attractive as the fire looks, when you touch it, it hurts. That's the reality. Now you want to build the romance, you can build whatever romance you want about candles, and one for Shomer, and one for Zocher, and this kind of candle, and that kind of candle, and menorahs, and candles represent neshomers, and you can go on to all the poetic heights you want. But before that, you've got to know, touch it, it hurts. That's the pshat of a candle. That's what a candle's all about. Now you want to add on all the drush and the kabbalah and everything, that's fine. But know the pshat first. The pshat is it hurts, and you'll never learn the pshat unless you try. That's how a father teaches a child, and that's how the Ribbono shel Olam teaches us. We have here the principle and basis of Yisurin. Chas v'sholem. When the Ribbono shel Olam brings suffering on us, this is what it's all about. Just to learn reality, just to learn what things really are. If you know what things really are, there should be no reason ever for Yisurin. It should be unnecessary. Now let's try and understand the Ramban. It says the Ramban, therefore, Kein Hashem Elokim Yasreko Mitchilo Be'inu Yamidba Ve'nisoyen Hamon She'te'arev Lenapshecha Toivas Ha'aretz. The correct translation of Te'arev Lenapshecha is not quite as we first translated it, which is so that it should be pleasant for you, because if that's what it meant, it should have been Ve'te'arev Lach. It should be pleasant for you. Ve'te'arev Lenapshecha means that it should enrich your lives. And there's a big difference between finding something pleasant and finding that something enriches your life. The Ribbono shel Olam is worried. He's putting his people into a land full of bracha, full of blessing, full of material wealth, full of everything they could possibly want. What's he worried about? Not that they won't find it pleasant. Sure, they'll find it pleasant. He's worried about, Te'arev l'napshecha, is it going to improve the quality of their lives or isn't it? And on what is that going to depend? You see, if one's eating bread, just a plain slice of bread, no butter, no jam, just the bread, the only way one can enjoy that bread really is just to understand what one's doing, where it comes from, that the Ribbono shel Olam has prepared this for you, that the Ribbono shel Olam has designed the whole economy of farmers and millers and bakers and distributors and retailers and everything so that you should have this slice of bread on your plate. What is bread? Where is it made from? What nourishment does it have? What's it going to do in your body? What effect is it going to have on you? What strength are you going to get? It's an amazing thing. There's a piece of bread. Here's me. By putting this inside me, I get strong and energetic. An incredible thing. If you understand all that and you eat your piece of bread, it tastes good. It gets digested well. It feels good. It's a physical experience. It's in fact a hedonistic experience. It's an emotional experience. It's a religious experience. It's everything. It's wonderful. It's the most wonderful experience. Just to sit and know what one's doing. What bread is, what I am, and what the relationship between bread and I is. That's really what the bracha is there for. To tell you what bread is, what I am, and what the relationship between me and the bread is. And when I understand that, and I eat the bread, dry piece of bread, no butter, no jam, no peanut butter, no marmalade, no honey, nothing. Tastes beautiful. Tastes wonderful. But if I don't do that, I've got to start putting all sorts of rubbish on the bread to make it nice. You must see what they put on bread in America. Unbelievable. Firstly, what they put in bread, and then what they put on their bread. You can't believe the rubbish that they put on. The unhealthy rubbish. Sweet as anything. It's awful. Because they can't taste the bread anymore. They've got to have something to make it tasty. So something artificial to stimulate their taste glands, their taste buds, so as to make the experience an interesting experience. They're incapable of doing it themselves. And they make all sorts of concoctions to put on the bread to make it better. And the sauces, I mean, you must go into a restaurant in Belgium or in France, and you must talk to them about American cooking. Or about American customers. They don't want Americans anywhere near. They throw the Americans out. Are they Americans here? Did you still consider yourself an American? They throw their Americans out of the place. They can't stand it. Why? All the sauces they put on this is they make all these sauces and these ketchups and all these millions of things that they put on to make the food taste good. Can't they cook nicely? I mean, what do they need all these things for? If the food is good, you don't need all these ketchups and things. And if the food isn't good, why don't they just eat ketchup? They can't understand. So what is it? They've got to eat the meat because it's got to be healthy, and to make it palatable, you've got to pour a lot of ketchup. So you've got the taste of the ketchup and the nourishment of the meat. They haven't been able to put the two together. South Africans aren't much better, by the way. Let's talk about the Americans. Just taking it from a restaurateur's point of view, from a chef's point of view, without even getting involved in the religious side, what is he complaining about? The inability of the person to be able to produce and test the essential qualities of the food that he's eating. And we take this just one step further. And we say, quite apart from the taste, not to be able to appreciate the spiritual qualities, the human qualities, but everything that's gone into it. Food, after all, is not just its ingredients. It's its ingredients and the preparation and the people that have made it what it is and the love and care and attention that has gone into making it what it is. Food is a whole lot of things. One has to taste all that. Then one doesn't need the ketchup. But if one's unable to taste that, one needs the ketchup. One needs lots of food, not a little bit of food. In Europe, they'll put very, very small portions. And you eat very slowly. Firstly, you eat very slowly because it's terribly expensive. And one just couldn't stand the thought of how quickly one can consume so much money. So you eat very slowly. And by eating slowly, enjoy it. Taste it carefully, you comment on it, this taste, that taste, you must hear them talking about their food. It's like talking about the pshat in Arabic Kivarigal. This could it be this, could it be that, they could have done it. Real, it's a chokhmah that goes into it, and slowly they eat and they digest it nicely, and they get up from a very small meal feeling fully satisfied. And you don't see so many overweight people over there, and you don't see so many, I was going to say you don't see so many lazy people there, maybe that's not true anymore, but be that as it may, it's a lot healthier. Whereas you go into an American restaurant and it's huge, big portions of ketchup all over, big quantity, lots of it, sweet as anything, all sorts of artificial tasting things. What is it? It's just one's unable to notice or to extract sufficient out of the food to be able to use a small piece. Because if you use a small piece and you extract it all out of that small piece, you don't need anything more. And that's the problem that the Ribbono Shel Olam has about going into Eretz Yisrael. If they don't see food for what it really is, if they don't relate to the food for what it really is, to the materialism for what it really is, to the money for what it really is, to the natural beauty for what it really is, if they don't do that, they're going to need quantity. They're going to need more and more. And to earn more and more, they're going to work harder and harder. And to work harder and harder, they're going to learn less and less. And they're going to keep Shabbos less and less. And they'll keep their special times for learning and for davening less and less. More, it's going to get more and more. They're going to get more and more involved until these outside activities and materialism becomes a substitute for the real thing. Now he needs his leather chair. Take away his leather chair and he can't make any money. He can't function without the leather chair. Why not? Because that's now important. This is what I'm working for. This is what I am. That's where it goes to. And if you look at the continuation, that's exactly what it comes to. Hishomer lecha pen tishkach es Hashem Elokecha. Be careful that you don't forget the Ribbono Shel Olam. Pen teichal besavata, in case you eat and get satisfied. You know, the Rambam paskens that you've got to eat just before, you've got to stop eating just before you're satisfied. It makes medical health as well, medical sense as well. Because it takes a long time for one's hunger to know whether it's been satisfied or not. And the tendency is to eat much more than one really needs to eat. If one would eat very slowly, one would find that one gets filled, one fills oneself up a lot quicker or on a lot less than if one eats fast. The Rambam says, always get up before you've had enough. When you've had enough, that's too much. What's the Rebbeinu Shalom worried about? I'm worried v'achalta v'savata, that you'll eat enough, that you'll eat until you've got enough. That's too much. Uvatim tovin tivne, and you'll build beautiful homes v'yoshavta, and you'll dwell in them. Uvekolcha v'tzoynecha yirbeyun, and your business will prosper, there'll be much of it. Your flock and your cattle will get many. V'chese v'zov yirbeelach, and you'll have plenty of money and silver and gold. V'cholasherlach yirbe, and there'll be more and more and more. Every verse, this yirbe comes in several times. The koch of itzonik yirbe yun, the chesed v'zav yirbe lach, the cholasherlach yarbe. Then the ram lavavech, or then you'll get arrogant. V'shachachta es Hashem lekecha mitziacha, you'll forget the Ribbono shel Olam, etc., etc., who brought you through all these difficult 40 years and so on and so forth. Back to where we started. That's what he's worried about. That you start using the trappings as the real thing. You start confusing the trappings. And that's what the Ramban means. Says the Ramban, what I'm worried about is not that you won't find it comfortable in Eretz Yisrael, not that it won't be pleasant for you, but sheterav lenafshecha, I want it to enrich your lives. In order for your life to be rich, you've got to be able to distinguish between the real thing and the trappings. That's what's terribly important, because then I can enjoy the trappings too. If I understand that what I really need is just a little piece of meat and a dry piece of bread and a glass of water with a piece of carrot, that's all I need today. And I get much more than that. I'm able to notice what I've got more and to appreciate it. But if I don't make that distinction in my mind continuously of what I need and what I've got, I'm unable really to be able to appreciate even the extras, even the luxuries. When I start thinking that luxuries are necessities, I don't appreciate luxuries anymore. There are no luxuries, and everything becomes necessities, and nothing's a necessity. This is total confusion. What's important in a land like Eretz Yisrael, or in a land like Eretz Yisrael was meant to be, is to know with absolute clarity what I need, and to appreciate all the extra as extras, and to understand that they're extras. Let's now look at the Ibn Ezra. Let me read you the Ibn Ezra again. Hatam, the reason is, or the meaning is, im rotzisem lishmer hamitzvahs leman tichyu. If you want to keep the mitzvahs in order to live, let's stop there. That means we have a choice. There are two ways to keep the mitzvahs. One way to live, and one way not to live. That's a very funny thing that Ibn Ezra is saying. If you want to keep the mitzvahs to live, but Ibn Ezra is of course 100% right. Mitzvahs can be a drag, and mitzvahs can infuse one with dynamicism and with vitality. If you do it with your right hand, says the Gemara, sama chayim, it gives you life. Do it with your left hand, sama moves, it's killing. The mitzvahs can actually drag one down, they can pull one down, they can be a miserable burden. And yet the mitzvahs can also be a wonderful thing. What does it depend on? If you want to do it to live, then zichru et haderech, remember the way of the 40 years. What's the one going to do with you? But this is an important Ibn Ezra. Without even understanding it yet, we can see that this is vital. That one can't be Jewish without this Ibn Ezra. And that's what one sees already, because there's a secret here for success in Yiddishkeit. It's the story that Ibn Ezra is telling us now. If you want to enjoy your Yiddishkeit, this is the way to do it. Remember the 40 years in the desert. That's what he's saying. Now let's understand the connection. Let me give you an example. You buy a house, and I say to you, you know, don't buy that house. It's standing on bad foundations and the walls are cracked. You say to me, look, you don't understand. Come inside. I want to show you my new house. Come inside. It's beautiful. It's wallpapered all over. Floor to floor, carpeting, not a crack, no sign of anything. Fantastic. I say, so what are you talking about? And I said, but don't you understand, this is wallpaper. Why is there wallpaper over all the walls? Looks very nice, but what's behind the wallpaper? And you say, I don't, what do I, it looks good, this is nice, what do I mind what's behind it? Comes a little while later and you've got to rip down the wallpaper. You call me in to fix your walls because something's gone wrong and I've got to tear down your wallpaper. And you feel so heartbroken. Your wallpaper's coming down. You know, that's a person who doesn't understand what a house is. What's the house? The house are the walls. Once there's walls and there's a roof on top of it, you can live in it. And when it rains, you don't get wet. That's what's important. Now you want to paint and put nice things and wallpaper. That's very nice. That's trappings, but that's not a house. A house is four walls with a door If you're lucky, a window and a roof over the top, that's a house. That's a place to live in. That's a cozy, comfy place to live in. That's all a human being needs. Anything more than that is already trappings. To get upset because I'm undoing your trappings to fix the essence, that's crazy. That means one doesn't understand what one's doing. But if it were the other way around, if you said, you know, I've got a house and I can afford to put wallpaper on as well, but I want you to come and fix the walls before I put the wallpapers on, then you have nachas. I come with my hammer and my chisel and I mess around there and plaster and make a big mess and clear up the mess, and you're as happy as anything. The one way, the second way we've just described, I've added to your house. In your view, I've improved your house. The other way, I've detracted from your house. I've taken down the wallpaper and you've got to go now and wallpaper the whole thing up again. That's the big difference. The mitzvahs improve the essence of life. The mitzvahs penetrate right past the trappings. They're not interested in the trappings. The Torah doesn't involve itself in the trappings. That's a matter of personal taste. The Torah doesn't tell you what color to paint your house. And the Torah doesn't tell you what color clothes to wear. And the Torah doesn't tell you all the trappings. That's your own business. Do it as you please. The Torah only talks about essence, about the things that really are important. And if you're operating on the level where you're relating to things as they really are, then every mitzvah strengthens life as it really is. But if you're operating as things appear to be, then every mitzvah is a drag. Let's just have a look at two examples and then we're finished. One example, business, profession, and Shabbos. I'm involved in my business and I'm enjoying it thoroughly. It's such a challenge and it's so rewarding. It requires such intellectual thought and planning. My mind is in it day and night. I'm rewarded for it. My salary is going up every month. They can't do enough for me. I walk in there and everybody stands up. They stand in absolutely awe of my wizardry. I feel so good when I go in. I feel so good when I come home. I'm being successful. It's wonderful. Comes Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock, to stop in the middle to get home for the Shabbos. Miserable. And Shabbos is a drag. And I'm not even allowed to think about my work. Got to switch off and think about something else. It's a drag. It's hard. Time to learn Torah. Got to stop. Go and daven mincha in the middle of the day. Got to stop the work. Go and daven mincha. It's such a drag. Stop what I'm doing in the middle and go and daven mincha. And if you've got another man. Well, let's take this man still and I would stop him in the street and I'd say, why do you work so hard? What will his answer be? Oh, I love it. It's my life. Okay, that's one kind of man. Take another man who understands. You say to him, why do you work? It's because it says in the Torah, B'zeya sapecha toicha lechem. What can I do? After Adam's chate, after Adam's sin, there was a curse on the world that you have to slave for your living. Do you think I wouldn't rather be slaving on a piece of Gemara? Or painting pictures? Or going for a walk? Sure I would. But it says, I've got to do it. Don't think I don't enjoy it. I enjoy it too. It's really very nice. Baruch Hashem, that at least the Ribbono Shel Olam has given me the opportunity to enjoy my work. Thank goodness. But it's a klal, it's a curse, and I know it. Why am I working? To earn a living. That's why I'm working. While I'm doing it, I'm enjoying it. Now you say to such a man, okay, friend, 4 o'clock on Friday you stop. What does he say? Baruch Hashem. I can sit down and learn for 24 hours without worrying. Not that he doesn't enjoy his work. Not that he's not equally good at his work, but he understands where his work fits in. The second man understands that as much as I enjoy it and I love it and all that, why am I working? Because I was cursed to work. And the first one has turned the curse into a blessing. He's so sick that he doesn't even realize that ideally it would be not to work. Ideal would be to be able to sit and work on things that are really important, not things that are only means to an end. The first man realizes that working is a means to an end. I need to keep myself together. I need to support my family. I need to educate them. I would like to have them to have the opportunity to sit and learn in yeshiva. I'm going to need a bit of money for that, so I'm working for that. That's why I'm working. Fine, okay. That's why I'm working, and I enjoy my work too. There's nothing wrong with that. The other man, why are you working? Love it. That, says the Rambam, is the essence of sickness. When you start loving things which are bad for you and hating things which are good for you. Not that working is bad for us. It's good for us. But it's good for us as a result of our having done something wrong a long time ago. It's not the ideal state. It's not the way things should be. So the mitzvah of Shabbos is not designed for the man who's living on the trappings. For the man who's sitting on his leather chair and can't operate without his leather chair because that's his ego. His success in his business is his success as a human being. And without that, take that away, he feels a nothing.
That man can't stop work when it comes to Shabbos. And when he does stop work, he feels empty and drained and miserable. But the man who might also be sitting on a leather chair or on a wooden chair, it doesn't matter, but it doesn't make any difference to him either. Sure, he's more comfortable on this chair, that's fine. But the main thing is, he's doing well, he's working hard, he's doing a job of work, he's getting paid at the end of the month, he's got what to eat, he's got where to sleep, he can educate his children, doesn't have to lie awake at night worrying about his panosa, that's why he works, and he enjoys every minute of it, but come Shabbos, it's a pleasure. It's the same Shabbos. But the one is living without the wallpaper, and the one only sees the wallpaper, that's all. The one sees behind the wallpaper, the other one doesn't. That's how it is. The Torah is designed for the essence. The Torah is not designed for the trappings. Another example. I don't think one needs other examples. I think with whatever mitzvah you decide to take, you'll find basically the same concept. Talk about marriage. One understands what marriage is all about. The mitzvahs of Taras HaMishpocha and all their details just enhances the marriage. Everything about the marriage becomes richer. And if marriage is just a convenience, marriage is just a thing that's taken for granted, if it's related to purely on a physical basis, Taras HaMishpocha is the biggest drag there can be. Same dinim, same laws, same people. One's living the essence and he's using the mitzvahs to enrich the essence, and one is living on the trappings. And the mitzvahs keep on tearing down the wallpaper. As soon as there's a crack in the wall, the Torah comes in and tears down the wallpaper. And some people resent it, because all they've got, Nebuch, is the wallpaper. But they don't understand that what the mitzvah is doing is reinforcing that wall, because there are cracks in the wall. And this is what the Ibn Ezra is telling us. Kol HaMitzvah. If you want to learn the mitzvahs, if you want to keep the mitzvahs in a way which they stimulate you, then take, for example, in learning Torah, something we discussed 2 weeks ago. When do you get tired and dead? When you're putting out. The same physically and spiritually is the same thing. When your output exceeds your input, you get fatigued. When your input exceeds your output, you build up stores. When you learn, at the point where you're machadish, where you create a new thought in Torah, where you've understood a new angle, where you've understood something that you never knew before. Is that input or output? That's input. You've created a new concept which you can now integrate. Even though you've slaved and you've been up all night to do it. Once you get to that point of the chiddush, you put it inside you, that's input. And it's far more input than all the output that it took to get there. That's why we have that pusuk which we discussed 2 weeks ago, which is that once it's li tvuna, once I'm doing it myself, then it's no longer mateshes, the Torah no longer weakens. However, one has to understand the realities of the two, like the candle. People get into learning and they think it's all making chidushi. That's what it's all about. Sure, it's all making chidushi. But oh, what goes into making a chidush? We've got a fellow who joined our business and he thought our business. I asked him once, I said, why did you join the business? He says, well, it looked good, flying all over the world. Just lovely. Do you know what goes into it before that? Nobody's not prepared to do that. Let others do that. Man of my intellect, wasting time on the details. That's the problem that we're working with all the time. Before you can make a chiddush on a piece of Gemara, do you know what it is? It's reading and translating the words 50, 60, 70 times at least. Because if not, your chiddush will be wrong. Absolutely wrong. That you must know. There's no way that you can hope to make a chiddush on a piece of Gemara until you've read and translated the words 50, 60, 70, 80 times, somewhere around there, just reading and translating. And then it's the Rashi, and every Rashi needs as much work as we've just put into the Ramban, just to understand what he's saying, no chidushim yet. And then it's over Gemara and Rashi 10, 15 times, and then you start with Tosfos, and then you start with the main Rishonim, and then you get to the Poskim, and it's over and over, and then it's the Moshe Kelim on the Poskim, and you understand it. Now you're ready to start making chidushim. But until that time, you're not ready to start making chidushim. And if you do, you're like the kid who thinks that a candle is a fairy. A very nice candle fairy. But try touching the fairy. See what happens. You're playing with fire. When one isn't prepared to confront reality, and one is only relating to it romantically, that's no good. There is a place for romance, but after the reality. you ask a couple, what is marriage? And they say love, companionship, being together, helping each other, supporting each other. Oh, it's all so beautiful and pretty. But they're going to burn their fingers, because that's not marriage. What is marriage? Depends who you're talking to. Ask a lady what marriage is. Ask a girl before she's engaged, never mind before she's married. And you'll hear all these things I've just said, but that's not true. What she's got to say and what she's got to know is, what is marriage? It's cooking, cleaning, preparing, raising kids, cleaning their nappies, cleaning up the house, entertaining visitors. That's what marriage is. Ask a man, what is marriage? It's working harder to support two people, or lowering your standard of living. It's having children and working still harder, or lowering your standard of living still further, having them around, educating them, raising them, waking up at the night for them. That's what marriage is. If you know that, now I can start telling you all about the romance. In addition to that, marriage is love, and marriage is being together, and it's companionship. It's fine, then you're all right. But you've got to know what it really is. You've got to know the pshat of marriage before you know the drush and the kabbalah. And the pshat of marriage is, it's a responsibility, it's an oil, that's what you're doing. Why then do people get married? It's a mitzvah in the Torah. That's why. It's a mitzvah, because if people really knew what marriage was, and they weren't religious, they wouldn't get married. Baruch Hashem, the Rebbeinu Shlom has made us stupid enough not to know what marriage is until it's too late. Because if it weren't for that, only religious people would get married. But that's the attitude that has to be. That's what marriage is. It's a heavy responsibility. It's a mitzvah which one does with all one's heart and with all one's love. The same as eating the mon. When one knows what it really is, right. Now if one's lucky enough, in addition to have the love and the companionship and the friendship and the stimulation and all the other things which marriage is supposed to be, that's all the extra tests. Now you can see your mon. Now you've got some for tomorrow as well. That's fine, but that's not the essence of the mon. One has to know the essence. And this is what the Ibn Ezra is telling us. That when you've got the essence, when you know that there's got to be hard work before you can make chidushi, and when you know that marriage is hard work, it's labor, it's responsibility, it's toil, before you can have the love and companionship. Because if you're not prepared to put in the hard work, let me assure everybody, you'll never have the love and companionship. You won't have an ezer, but you'll have a kenegdo. You'll have battles and problems, unless you're prepared to put your shoulder to the wheel and do what marriage really is. The same as you'll never make a chiddush which is healthy unless you're prepared to work on the Gemara the 60, 70, 80 times that we're just talking about. The same way that you'll never be able to know Latin if you don't master the declensions and the conjugations and just learn them off by heart like a parrot. Just too bad. That's what you need before you can progress, and without that there can't be creative thinking. Without that there can't be input. It's all got to be output in the beginning. You've got to invest and invest and invest. Hazorim bedimo. It's only after you've invested with tears that you can joyously bring in the benefits. But we're living in a generation that wants to invest joyously and quickly, and quickly bring in the benefits equally joyously. It just doesn't work like that. It doesn't work like that economically. It doesn't work like that in interpersonal relationships. It doesn't work that way in Torah. The investment is years of hard labor, and then the reaping is joy. Says the Ibn Ezra, you've got to decide. Do you want the mitzvahs laman tishyun? Do you want rino? Do you want vitality and enjoyment in your mitzvahs? Or do you want it to be a drag? If you want it to be a drag, forget about the 40 years in the midbar. Forget about the concentration camps and the last war. Just think about the wallpaper. It's all nice. And the mitzvahs are going to drag you down all along the way. If you want the mitzvahs to be chayus, if you want the mitzvahs to be life, then you must understand what life really is. Life is the way it was in the desert. That's what life is. Life is what it was in Auschwitz. That's what life is. Everything else is luxury. Those that survived Auschwitz were living on the bottom level. But that's what life is. If you have a private toilet to yourself, that's a luxury already. That's not life. If you have more than that little ration that they handed out, that's not luxury. That's not life. That's luxury. You've got to understand what life is. And if you see life chas v'sholem as Auschwitz, if you see life as the difficult 40 years that they had in the desert life, then one can begin to enjoy oneself. And every mitzvah is a beautiful thing. Every word of Torah is an enrichment. Every luxury is lapped up with great enjoyment. And every necessity is appreciated. That's the requirement of kol ha-mitzvah. All the mitzvahs which I'm commanding you today, if you want to do them, laman tichyun, says the Ibn Ezra, says the Torah, the Zohar says, "Kol haderech, remember all those 40 years the little bit of mon that you had, the clothes you didn't buy, shoes you didn't wear. That's what life's all about. All the rest are trappings which are enjoyable and comfortable, but by no means essential.